I don't know about you, but when I'm using AI for my business, I don't need it to tell me what to do. I know what I want. I just need help making it happen. With Wix, I finally have an AI tool that gets things done the way I want. I just have to describe the type of website I need, and it's ready. I can even ask it to manage my inventory, plan my next marketing campaign, or help out my customers. Wix gives me AI wherever I need it. Try it out at Wix.com.
Welcome to the Literature Lounge, where writers and authors share their stories behind their stories.
Sweet Malida, a mix of water softened, flattened rice, sugar, dried fruits and nuts, was a dish made for Shabbat or for breaking our fast. Cooling, light on the palate and to the body and spirit, it was welcome in the heat of day or night. We had many foods in common with our Muslim, Christian, and Hindu neighbors, and we often celebrated together their festivals or ours. I relished particularly fresh coconut, the regional staple, its milk or its flesh.
Tell me a little bit about what does food mean to you, spiritually, culturally? What is the meaning of that in the Bene Israel dishes that, you know, you talk a lot about?
So there's a lot connected with tradition, with all of us, without our mothers and grandmothers who fed us and cooked for us, you know, and we never thanked them for it, you know. They were always taken for granted. So in many ways, this is a way of bringing them to life and saying, I'm here because of you. I'm here because of your food. I'm here because you nurtured me, you know, in every way. So in a way, all of that came together in this book. So I meet with Jamaican Jews. I meet with African Jews. And there are groups called Jews of Color. And they've invited me to come and speak because they didn't know about Indian. So we talk about how Jamaican Jews, how African, Uganda and Ethiopian Jews are some of the, like us, one of the most ancient communities. So part of what I do when I go and talk is saying, you know, peel those layers back. There are ancient communities, way more ancient than the European ones.
Hi, in today's episode, we have with us Zilka Joseph, a poet and author, whose work bridges Indian and Western cultures, reflecting her Bene Israel Jewish heritage. Born in Mumbai and raised in Kolkata, she now lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Her poetry has appeared in renowned journals such as Poetry, Kenyon Review Online and Michigan Quarterly Review, and in anthologies like 101 Jewish Poems for the Third Millennium. She has received numerous accolades, including multiple Pushcart nominations, a Zell Fellowship, and a Forward Indies Book Award finalist recognition for her collections, including Sharp Blue, Search of Flame, and In Our Beautiful Bones, her latest book, Sweet Malida, Memories of a Bene Israel Woman, celebrates history, food, and traditions of her community. Zilka is also a creative writer, teacher, editor, and a mentor. Her book is Sweet Malida, Memories of a Bene Israel Woman, and I was reading about her, and I'm overwhelmed to have her on our podcast today. So welcome, Zilka. So first, let's just straightaway dive in into Sweet Malida, which is a very rich and evocative collection. I was reading the poetry, you know, and obviously there is nostalgia, mm-hmm. There is a sense of belonging. So tell us a little bit about the tone and about what inspired you to write the book. What was that, a feeling of wanting to belong, a sense of feeling, distorted from the past? Was it all of that and more?
Yes. Thank you, Mohua, for having me. I'm just so honored to be here and to speak with you particularly about this book, which is my sixth collection and which is my first book that has been published in India. So that's very meaningful to me. So talking about how the book began, the way a book is, you don't just sit down and write a book. You are writing various pieces, various poems, putting them into folders, collecting them. And then you have, when you start looking at them, you realize how you can pull these different themes into a book. So a lot of craft, a lot of deep thought goes into actually creating a book. A book is just written. It's written in various stages. There are various themes that you pull together. But this book began in a very interesting way, because as you can tell from the book, that I love food. I love researching food. I love reading about food. And I love the stories connected with food. I think that's so basic to any of us who are creative people or writers or people just connected with the world around us. So I actually had a very a collection of poems about several Bene Israel dishes. And it was published by a very interesting journal. It's called Rasa, or Rasa, if you want to put it that way, which is an imprint of Whetstone magazine, which has a great reputation. Stephen Satterfield, who made that documentary High on the Hog. So I was extremely thrilled when they said we are putting out a new imprint and we'd like this whole section on Ben Israel food. And then I wrote a little introduction, you know, I wrote a little introduction to that book. I'm sorry, the poems. So then that gave context. And then I realized from there, I began putting together, of course, I knew the history, but then to get the exact dates and the exact times of different aspects, then I started putting together more and more work and more poems. I had short prose poems, and that's how the book began.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's initial scaffolding.
Yeah. So, you know, just for our readers, I think I want to read Sweet Melida.
I would love to. I would love to. So that is the title of the book. And this is the book where the artwork was also created by a Ben Israel artist and friend.
I would love to read Sweet Melida, and I'm going to ask you to read another one.
Sure, I would love to. I would love to. So Malida is the name of the dish. I've just called it Sweet Malida because that sort of sets the tone for the essence of the book. Sweet Malida, a mix of water-softened, flattened rice, sugar, dried fruits and nuts, was a dish made for Shabbat or for breaking our fasts. Cooling, light on the palate and to the body and spirit, it was welcome in the heat of day or night. We had many foods in common with our Muslim, Christian, and Hindu neighbors, and we often celebrated together their festivals or ours. I relished particularly fresh coconut, the regional staple, its milk or its flesh, added to almost every dish. But this was to me the best way to eat it, finely grated by my mother's hands, left unsweetened and sprinkled haphazardly on the malida, juicy threads with a fleck of stubborn brown kernel here and there, that sometimes crunched in your teeth like sand, and you winced and swallowed it, knowing there was no simpler or purer or truer form than that.
Oh, that's beautiful. I read that. And, you know, I mean, I was just so totally in love. And I would really like to read also another one of your poems. The other one that is called The Angels of Konkan.
Konkan, yes. I will definitely read that because that absolutely is a little glimpse into the history and mythology. So I'm very, very happy to read that for you and for the audience, because this is where the shipwreck of my ancestors on the coast, Konkan coast. And then this is a creative rendering of what might have occurred. And then the sense of gratitude. The Angels of Konkan, and this town, this village actually exists, the cemetery exists, the Angels of Konkan. Navgaon, Maharashtra is where it is believed the ancestors of the Ben Israel were shipwrecked and where a ruined cemetery exists today. From tumbled sands and shattered bark, blurred shadows dragged us. Where were we? They dried our battered bodies, bound our wounds, clothed us in woven cotton, fed us warm food with their hands that we could not name then. And as Elijah ate of bread and flesh that ravens gave him, so also we ate and drank of the cool water brought from brooks. Who were these healers? Then in fields of grass near the sea, we buried our dead, the ones we found. Where are they now? Set gravestones to remember. They let us pray as we wished, and giving thanks to Adonai, we learned the craft of oil pressers, or did our tribe know it already? Ate what our laws permitted, and praising this vast green land, its rich soil, its rivers, its ghats, its grains, its fish and fowl, we blessed the hearts and the living hands of the villagers who saved us.
Oh my God, that is so profound. It is so beautiful. You also open your book with an essay that's titled What's in My Bones, you know, which introduced the Bene Israel community's history, right? And me, for the first time, I was actually reading up about it and I did not know. And obviously, this had a huge influence in your life. So could you share some of the history, you know, for our listeners, you know, how it shaped you personally and, of course, creatively?
Yes, of course. So that essay that's published in the book was actually published on the Jewish Book Council's website. They have a section called Paper Brigade Daily. And this was also a way of me introducing the history of my community and then a little glimpse into my background. So it's very brief and I thought it would make a wonderful really like brief introduction to who I am and what the book is about. And I think what in the West people almost know nothing about the Indian Jewish cultures, or sometimes even the Sephardic or Mizrahi Jewish cultures, because the dominant culture is Ashkenazi. And they sort of focus on their history and their knowledge, and very little is known about this community. Very little is known in India as well now. So I'm hoping that there will be more curiosity and more people will read and understand how much richer this country's culture is because of how much they've embraced every culture. So coming back to your question about what's in my bones, the history of the Ben Israel itself goes back to one of the dates, at least we believe that they arrived, is 175 BCE, which puts people into shock because they don't even realize that their arrival was 2,000 years ago. And if that's not the deep fabric of this beautiful country, 2,000 years before it was India, before Israel, it was some Judea, they were not even named, you know, so that's when we were living in the villages of the Konkan. So that part of it. And then the history of the community is woven in with my own story. So being born in Bombay, and of course being influenced early by this our culture. But what I must explain is that my background was not very religious. Even though we were immersed in the food and culture and the stories, and my grandmother would read to me, and I was always fascinated with books and mythology and storytelling. And you'll see that culminating in this book in many ways, where I'm bringing in the stories of my childhood, bringing in the stories of my grandfather, grandmother, my parents, my father, who is a marine engineer. So you'll see many of those themes interwoven into this book. And I think so much of the interest in mythology and creative storytelling became part of me as a writer. So I think this book sort of brings together history, mythology, my own family history, and most importantly, the theme of migration across generations. So if you start with the boats that were shipwrecked, if you go into the history of my grandparents, my grandfather being in the British Army as a doctor and going to Egypt and Palestine and tending to the soldiers there. My father being a marine engineer, so connection to the sea again. And then my travel from Kolkata to the US and then to a new culture and blending all these cultures. So that's how the layers of the book sort of unfold.
So there's a lot of food, right, which is really the central theme, you know, of your book.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm always so sad about the fact that so many recipes are just dying a natural death. And very few people, and I often talk about this, you know, that very few people are cooking any longer at home.
That's
and,
true.
You know, so I remember while I was growing up, you know, all the food that was made at home, many of those dishes are not cooked any longer because Ma doesn't cook anymore after, you know, I lost my father. And there are a lot of the, you know, ingredients that are not probably available with migration because we've migrated as Bengalis.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, what does food mean to you and, you know, spiritually, culturally, what is the meaning of that in a, you know, in the Bene Israel dishes that, you know, you talk a lot about?
Yeah, as I explained, the book's impetus really was food. And then the story sort of built up around that. And one of the things I've already mentioned is my love of food and my curiosity about, I won't say food anthropology exactly, but just how families connect with food and how we take food for granted when we're small. We don't think about it. And then till we lose it, we suddenly realize, I don't have my mother now to make the poha for me. I don't have anybody to say, you know, there's this green curry, you know, I made green curry today. So I think so much of that comes with, at least for me, a lot of it came with the loss of my home, loss of my parents, and this sort of desire to bring it all alive, bring them alive, bring these foods alive. In a way, and I didn't think I was doing it consciously. Just as a writer, I was drawing on these resources of memory and taste and senses, because without senses, writers are nothing. We have, the world is filtered through those senses. And I think it was so intense and so much, so intrinsic that I don't think I even consciously thought about any of that when I was pulling these stories together. It's only when as an editor you step back and you're arranging these stories in a very conscious way that you realize how, you know, you're building, you're layering this food and memory and culture. So it really, in a sense, became a memoir in some ways. It became a hybrid form, you know, because I have short prose pieces that I had and which fit beautifully into this collection. So a lot of that sort of came together, but it began with food and memories of the women in the family making and doing. So yeah. There's a lot connected with tradition, with all of us, without our mothers and grandmothers who fed us and cooked for us, you know, and we never thanked them for it, you know. They were always taken for granted. So in many ways, this is a way of bringing them to life and saying, you, I am here because of you. I'm here because of your food. I'm here because you nurtured me, you know, in every way. So in a way, all of that came together in this book.
Oh, it's beautiful. I need to talk to you a little bit about, you know, Prophet Elijah.
Yes.
How does, you know, Elijah symbolize to you personally? You know, you've talked about migration. You've talked about different cultures that you've embraced, you know, so how has the identity and the faith of your community, you know, what does it mean to you?
Ever see an idea so clearly in your head, but struggle to find the time to get it all done? Wix helps you go from,
I'll get to it,
to
done.
Build a full site just by describing your idea. Let an AI agent handle daily tasks, plan your next marketing campaign, or help out customers so you can grow your business the way you want without it taking over your life. Try it out at Wix.com.
As I mentioned before, I personally, my family personally were not religious. We did celebrate certain holidays, like we did Rosh Hashanah, and we had other families that we would celebrate. So they would basically invite us for the feasts, and we would be there to enjoy it and say prayers for Passover and things. My grandmother was a little more conservative, so we did have some prayers and some things. But basically, Shabbat, as you see in the book, is symbolically very important to me. Prophet Elijah, again, comes to me through storytelling. And if you, you know, there's stories from the Bible about this dramatic, fiery personality. Again, great storytelling, you know. And how was he connected to the Ben Israel is very interesting, because he lived in the desert, and there was this period of time where God told the ravens to feed him because he was preserving him. And then right at the end, he was sent up in this fiery chariot. So that's where the story of the Ben Israel come in, because it is believed that on his way in this fiery chariot up to the heavens, that he actually landed in this little village in the Western Ghats. And the Ben Israel who lived in that area saw him and witnessed it. So it was like a visitation to them. And there's this rock that exists today. People go on pilgrimages there, where there's this cleft in the rock. It's believed that the wheels of the chariot burned it, or, you know, it just ripped the rock apart. And there's this hoof print of a horse. And again, you know, how mythology and history and storytelling all meld together. So this has become a pilgrimage point, and people go there and actually do Malida ceremonies. So Malida is a dish,
yes,
but the Thanksgiving ceremony is called the Malida ceremony. So that's how that's connected. I've also heard stories that people who were shipwrecked perhaps saw the prophet Elijah, and they believe that perhaps saved them. But this again has become part of the hearsay and the storytelling. I know for a fact that the rock, the story of the rock, is very much past. So you'll find pictures of Prophet Elijah and the rock. For me personally, it was the wonderful story aspect of it, and the fact that these you know, stories of prophets are always fascinating, because there's a mysticism, there's a mystery, there's an unknown quality about it, which you can interpret in so many ways.
Absolutely.
And the mysticism is something that I'm always been attracted to. So I felt this was a wonderful way to bring in Elijah, bring in the, you know, the drama of it, and then the drama of him arriving on this rock and leaving. So it just brought the story like full circle. So I thought, as a device in the book, as a conscious craft, I thought it fit in very well with the rest of the storytelling.
What does poetry mean to you, Silka?
I don't even know how I was attracted. From childhood, I was attracted to write to poetry, to storytelling, and because so much of it was read to me, and I absorbed it. And I just loved it from the very start without knowing why. And I had no idea that I would be a writer. I had no idea that I would be writing poetry at the serious, deep level, committed level that I write today. I did write poetry as a child, you know, a lot of rhyming, a lot of little fun things. And then in college. So I think I should attribute some of, you know, I should be grateful for some of the opportunities I got there to write poetry, got published in a few local journals. And I don't know if you remember, Moa, there used to be something called the Wall magazine. And I was the editor, I was the literary head. So we would put up people's writing on the board, print it out, and then type. We should actually type it out. There was no printing or any of that. And then post it on the board. So there'd be poetry section, short stories, art. So, you know, when I think back, I think, you know, those are the things that probably fed some of my creativity. But in those days, nobody, at least not my family, they were not an academic family. And They encourage reading, writing, music, all my interests. But I don't think we seriously thought that writing was a profession. You know, teaching, yes, I went into teaching right away. But it was only much later when I came to the US and I had a lot of time on my hands and I sort of really began taking these classes and attending things. And then people would say, my goodness, this is a wonderful poem. You know, I began to study more and then I got published. I got published before I got into my MFA program. So it's a long, long, many stories, many, many lives together.
Nice to hear that from you in person. And I need to ask you about your book because it's the importance of preserving one's identity, you know, amidst globalization. And, you know, it is a very tough call because there are so many children today who leave their homes and, you know, migration has had a huge impact, right, in the generations ahead. So what advice would you give to people who are really striving to hold on to their roots, including me? I try and hold on. And for me, it's been like coming back to it with a vengeance. The more, you know, older I grow, it's about holding on to those feelings, those memories that remind me of home. You know, the aroma, the fragrance, the food, all of that. What would you tell, you know, for youngsters who really are lost sometimes?
That's a very important question, and truly, you know, as the world opens up more and more, and we're traveling and living in other places.
How many times have you wished you could be in two places at once? With Wix, you practically can. Wix's website builder is packed with powerful AI tools to make running your business online easier. Build a full site just by talking with AI. Get an AI agent to manage your sales and marketing. Or work like a 10-person team, even if it's just you. So you don't need superpowers to get everything done. You just need Wix. Try it out for yourself at Wix.com.
For some people, they're comfortable with that. They, you know, we're always changing. We're reinventing ourselves as we go. For many of us, you know, when we lose our grandparents, we often lose some very deep roots. And I work with women immigrants everywhere, and I work more with older people, and I tell them, please write your stories down so that your children know where they came from. Your grandchildren know where they came. Sometimes languages, they're speaking Kannada, they're speaking Bengali, and the children, grandchildren in the US or the UK or Australia, wherever they are, they don't know their language, which happens. I mean, you know, it's a loss, but that's part of the invention and reinvention as we, the diaspora. But connecting to your roots and remembering the stories of our ancestors and our grandparents. So writing down these stories, just as stories, you don't have to publish them, you don't have to do anything, just put them together. Because I realized when I lost my parents, how much I lost of their stories.
Yeah.
I didn't ask my mother so many stories of Karachi. The Jewish community in Karachi, we were all one big country. Karachi was not Pakistan, right? We were all one. So I realized how much I needed to remember and bring back in whatever form. And of course, memory is always questionable. We're putting it. But so it's not just nostalgia, and it's preservation. And it's preservation in whatever form, whether it's poetry, whether it's prose, mixture of both. But somebody can pick it up and say, I remember the smell. I remember the shape of this puri. I remember my grandmother wearing that sari and, you know, sweating in the kitchen over there. So without those sense memories, and as you said, the aroma, I mean, smell, taste, all of that. So in a way, I did not realize then how much food memory would recreate not just the stories of my family, but the stories of this community. And some other Ben Israel family person may read this and say, this is not exactly how my mother made this. But that's all right, because each family will have a different tradition.
Absolutely.
Right? There will be different ways. And since we're talking about food and you said recipes are being lost, I just wanted to mention the novelist Esther David, who, you know, these are models, these are icons of Nissim Ezekiel, Esther David are icons for people like myself. And she has written this book called Bene Appetit, where she has done research on all the different communities and published the recipes. So I often talk about this in tandem with my book because people have asked me, why didn't you put recipes into this book? And I said, no, it's a literary form. I didn't want, but people ask me and their podcasts or their blogs, then I give them a recipe or two. But I always refer, I have a bibliography at the back. And I mentioned this book by Esther David, where she has collected recipes from the Ben Israel, from the Cochini Jews, from the Baghdadi Jews. And the two newest discoveries, not so new, is the Bene Menashe and then the last one, I forget, the Andhra Jews. So there's Northeast and Andhra Jews. So it's
God, very amazing, Zilka. I really did not know. Awesome. Wow.
I hope so much, Mohua, you're helping me to create some curiosity. And I want people in India to realize how, you know, there's so much more that's there. And in the West, they know nothing. So when I talk to them, I want them also to be curious because they can be very dismissive about anything that's not Western or not European. Because East European is, the Ashkenazis are basically East European and European Jews. And after the Holocaust, the focus has been on preserving their culture. So I meet with Jamaican Jews, I meet with African Jews, and there are groups called Jews of Color. And they've invited me to come and speak because they didn't know about Indian. So we talk about how Jamaican Jews, how African, Uganda and Ethiopian Jews are some of the, like us, one of the most ancient communities. So part of what I do when I go and talk is saying, you know, peel those layers back. There are ancient communities, way more ancient than the European ones. So I want people to sort of peel back the layers and be curious, embrace, you know, how rich these cultures are.
Yeah. Amazing. So finally, Zilka, what's next for you? Is there any other projects in the pipeline that you'd really like to talk about, exploring the heritage and other facets of your own identity?
Yes, Mo. This is my sixth book, as I mentioned. And all my books are on different subjects, related, of course. There's always the history of my parents, of course, my growing up in Kolkata. So I have a lot of poems that link to all of that. And each book is different, stylistically a little different. And that's what we do as writers, right? We grow, we experiment, we have different forms. So a lot of it is, I do have another manuscript that actually was ready before this one. And I couldn't find a publisher for it. So it was sort of on the back burner. But this one sort of developed. And I had the Mayapple Press, who's also published In Our Beautiful Bones. She loved the book and she published it. And then I managed to get it published through Piparan Books UK, Prabhu Guptara, wonderful man, who supported me. And now Penguin Random House brought out the book in India. But yes, I'm hoping that the other book comes through once I'm done with this book. But I'm really working hard, Mohua, and I'm hoping that more colleges and institutions will invite me to speak. I'm doing a round of some of the festivals now, but an exciting book that's in the works is a collaboration with Yael Silliman, who is the Baghdadi Jewish writer from Calcutta, and a few other writers.
That's wonderful.
We're trying to put together an anthology of Indian Jewish women writers.
How wonderful is that? Yael is a very good friend.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and I just absolutely admire her.
She has done a great deal of work to preserve history, and she's a historian. I mean, I'm delving into history, but more as a creative writer and poet. But she is actually preserving and researching the history, and she speaks as a historian rather than and of course she's a writer as well. But she and I and a few other writers that you will hear about very soon, I'm sure. Right now it's in the draft stages, and we're working on the drafts together. So that's a little secret, but an open secret in a way.
Lovely. I'm so glad to get the secret out of you.
So we're working on that. So that should be, I have no idea, because we are still looking for a publisher, and Yael is dealing with that aspect, and I will be helping her also with the editing process as we go.
So. Wonderful. Thank you, Zilka, for taking out the time today to be on our podcast, and all the best. And thank you for taking writing such a beautiful book.
Thank
it's been an honor for me too.
Thank you, Mahua.
Say what you want about AI, but it's here, and it's helping businesses get more done in a day. Wix's website builder is infused with AI so you can stay ahead. Create a beautiful, functional website just by describing your idea. Track how your site appears in AI search results. Create custom images on demand, or launch an entire campaign in a matter of minutes. Wix gives you AI wherever you need it. Try it now for free at wix.com.